you got to decide what role you want to play in society. Are you on the side where you want to build breakthroughs? Are you on the side where you want to go with the flow, status quo? It doesn't make you a bad person if you want to go with the flow, but people don't accidentally decide to create breakthroughs. Breakthrough thinking is a choice.
That's the voice of Mike Maples. He won't be asking the interview questions this time. Instead, I'm going to do a guest takeover with him as the guest. I'm Shane Parrish, founder of Farnham Street Blog and the Knowledge Project podcast, and it's go time with Mike Maples.
Welcome to Starting Greatness, a podcast dedicated to ambitious founders who want to go from nothing to awesome super fast. When you're a startup founder, you have to channel your inner James Bond, your MacGyver, your Wonder Woman. I'm going to help you win by curating the lessons of the super performers, but before they were successful. So without further ado,
ignition sequence start.
Let's get started. This is a different type of episode because we flipped the script. It started with a conversation between me and my friend Shane Parrish of Farnham Street, one of my favorite blogs on the internet. As we started to share ideas about the future, I asked Shane to come on the show to help with this episode. I've been thinking about the topic of the future a lot and feel a burning need to get some ideas out there. The present has stopped working, but the future can still be what we make of it, especially when ambitious founders choose to create a better future of their design. Shane, thanks for doing this. Let's get to it.
Mike, it's so good to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise.
So you read Marc Andreessen's manifesto, It's Time to Build, and where did your mind go?
Yeah, so it's funny because, you know, I really enjoyed our conversation last time about just mental models for startup investing. But there's another set of thoughts that I've had brewing, I guess a different set of mental models, if you will, around how do you create a breakthrough in the first place? Let's say you're an entrepreneur, and rather than evaluate a startup, what would you do if you were starting something from scratch, but you wanted it to be meaningful? Because not all ideas are equal. And I thought that when Mark came out with his manifesto, I thought this would be a good time to put some of those thoughts out there, because people would read that and say, hey, I want to build something. It's time to build. Okay, now what? And so I, inspired by Mark's post, I thought this is a chance to talk about the steps to having a breakthrough. You know, is there a scientific method, if you will, for discovering ideas that are breakthroughs versus not? Fundamentally, I think you can believe one of two things. You either believe that innovation is kind of random, throw a bunch of ideas at the wall, see what sticks, or you believe that there are theories about how innovation can happen. My goal in backcasting was to come up with a theory. I wanted to say, you know what, there's a set of steps that you can take that will non-trivially affect the odds of you encountering a breakthrough. And it starts with inflections, and then it goes to conversations where you ask the right questions to practitioners and seers. And then from that, you gather a catalog of insights. And ultimately, insights should lead to a breakthrough if they're really an insight. Otherwise, it's just you're analyzing facts.
Wait, go deeper on that for a second.
Yeah. So to me, like an insight is an unrecognized truth that could lead to a breakthrough. When you think about breakthroughs, people in the present believe the future is going to be an extension of the present. So that's what they think is probable. But when you gather an insight, you find a future based on an inflection that seems improbable to someone living in the present, but is more probable in the future to happen than people realize. As an entrepreneur, on some level, you're making a bet. That's an arbitrage, right? That it's a underpriced future breakthrough by the market of today. And so you're saying, yeah, I may be wrong. In fact, the odds may even be against me, but the risk-adjusted return of the bet is high because it's wildly asymmetric because it's a breakthrough. And what you find is if you do those things, most people, the odds are higher than they realize, but most people either don't have the tools to think this way or they just don't do the work. The reason I got passionate about this is I feel now, Shane, that you got to decide what role you want to play in society. Are you on the side where you want to build breakthroughs? Are you on the side where you want to go with the flow, status quo? And it doesn't make you a bad person if you want to go with the flow, but people don't accidentally decide to create breakthroughs. Breakthrough thinking is a choice. And it's like, I think, you know, I see, what is it now? Just in our country alone, in the US, there's 40 million unemployed. And it's like, we need the 21st century equivalent of the greatest generation right now, right? We need people, you know, like my grandfather who helped us through the Depression and fought in World War II. And it's like, you know, we talk about Gen X, Gen Z, baby boomers, whatever. But what we need right now in this world today is to recognize that the present isn't working. And so we need to decide, we need to make a choice to make a different future. But we need to be intentional about that choice rather than just hope for the best. And so, like, part of why I wanted to get some of these thoughts out there is my hope is that there will be enough people who are determined to create breakthroughs that if armed with the proper tools, that they'll make it happen. I like to say there's 20 great breakthrough startups a year, but on some level, that's not the true statement. There's really 20 great breakthrough insights a year. And ordinary people with insights can do extraordinary things. A lot of these founders I've worked with, they're billionaires now. Like, they're more ordinary than you think, but they just committed themselves to thinking about the world in a different way and acting on their vision and not giving up and just having the grit and the hustle and the just do the work to just follow it through all the way out into the future.
What are breakthroughs? Like, what's the difference between breakthrough and sort of like, I guess, incremental improvement would be the alternative?
I think so. So like on some level, breaking through all involves breaking free of the current set of rules, right? And so most people, and the reason that I use the term backcasting for coming up with breakthroughs is most people tend to forecast because they project forward from what's already happening. But the problem with that is if you want a breakthrough, you're going to always bring the baggage of the past with you, right? And if you have a breakthrough, it's sort of axiomatic that you want a different future. It's axiomatic that you don't want the status quo to persist. And so therefore, breakthrough is a meaningfully different and better future outcome, at least in the context of my business.
I think everybody, I was telling one of my friends this once, and he was sort of being like, oh man, I want to be an entrepreneur like you. And I was like, everybody wants to be an entrepreneur until you can't make payroll.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right. And then you're the one staying up at night, you know, leveraging your credit cards or your mortgage and then it's not so sexy anymore.
Yeah. Most people, when they say that, what they really want is the trappings of being an entrepreneur, the cover of a magazine, the adulation, those types of things. But like I like to say, you know, the present is stubborn. The present doesn't want the future to happen. It exerts a very strong gravitational pull. And so as an entrepreneur, it's like our ideas have to achieve escape velocity. Right? They have to escape the present. They have to break free of the present. And that requires incredible force and determination and will and consistency of direction. But it's not going to break free of the present by itself.
So how do we do that?
Yeah. So it's not easy, but I think that there's a few steps. So the first step actually, I think, has to do with two states of mind that are really important. So a lot of people tend to talk about the future like it's the weather, that it happens to us, or I want a crystal ball so I'll know what's going to happen in the future so I can take advantage of it. And I just reject that wholeheartedly, right? So I think the future is what we make of it. And I think that the future happens because certain people have a determined idea of what a better future could look like. And then they convince people who live in the present to join their movement to create that different future. Having agency, having personal agency that, yes, ordinary people can do extraordinary things and that the future isn't what we stumble into. It's what we make of it. It's not the weather. It's not something you forecast. It's something that you you go out and make happen. And then I think that the second really important but related point is get out of the present. A great friend of mine, Steve Blank, I think made a huge contribution to entrepreneurship by saying, get out of the building. And he would do that in the customer development phase. But what I wanted to do with backcasting was to say, okay, customer development's a tool for getting product market fit once you have an idea. backcasting is a tool for figuring out if your insight is powerful enough to create a breakthrough in the first place. And in order to do that, you have to get out of the present, not get out of the building. And so that, I think that's the second mental shift, is that you want to get out of the present in your frame of reference.
How do you do that? Because like, it seems like we're stuck in the present, right? Like we see what's right in front of us. We have this emotional connection to whatever our problems are right now. And sometimes we talk about these big ideas with our friends, but they're in the same situation, right? Like they're probably not a reliable source of like what a good idea in the future is.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what you find is that most people live in the present, and they kind of just operate with the world for how it is. And they kind of follow the rules for what they are. I like to say that, though, there are people out there that I call seers, and they live in the future. And part of the job, if you want to build a breakthrough, is to have the right types of conversations with seers. We can get to this. The type of conversations you want to have with seers are different. They're more interested in studying the future than they are in delivering something in the present. And so if you ask them, hey, what product do you think is missing? They're going to look at you funny, right? They're going to be like, I don't even care about that. That's boring. So like with seers, the types of conversations I like to have is, and this is why it's backcasting. So a forecast is a forward projected future. A backcast says, well, what if there are alternative potential futures? And I like to say some futures are plausible, some are possible, and some are preposterous. And what you try to do is tease out potential plausible, possible, and preposterous futures by having these conversations with the seers and asking questions about those scenarios, but not being too attached to, so therefore they need to give me the idea, right? It's more like you're trying to expand the realm of the insights that you want to pursue. So it's the right conversations with the right people.
But how do you know the difference between like a seer and a crazy person?
Yeah, sometimes you don't, right? And it's tricky because, if I were going to say, what are the steps, right? The first step in my mind is you find inflections, because inflections are the asymmetric weapon of an entrepreneur. And we can talk about those, but you know, there are different types of inflections. There are technology inflections, there's adoption inflections, regulatory inflections. And
let's start at the basics. What is an inflection?
Yeah. So to me, an inflection is, it's like a turning point. So it's a turning point that foreshadows not an incremental change, but a significant change. And so, for example, in technology inflections, probably the most well understood, you have something that people call Moore's Law, which says that the number of transistors will double on a chip at a given price every year and a half to 2 years. But there are other technology inflections that are possible. The sequencing and genome computing or AI power of an edge device per dollar or per watt of energy. You want to be able to quantify a technology inflection, right? And then the next kind of inflection is an adoption inflection. And that could be quantified as well. So for example, in 2010, about 10% of people had smartphones. And you could have said, oh, okay, I believe by 2015, maybe 50% will. And so that would be an adoption inflection. And these inflections can combine in powerful ways. So for example, when we invested in Lyft at the time, it was Zimride, we believed that the GPS locators in the iPhone 3GS had gotten 10 times more accurate, and that we were heading into a world where a majority of people would have smartphones. And so you think about that was Lyft's why now. Like you could say the phones are going to be accurate enough to locate drivers and riders accurately on a map, but there's also going to be enough people who have them to create a network effect. And so now you could visualize a world where somebody creates a transportation network. Whereas if you'd done Lyft even 3 years earlier, you wouldn't have been able to find each other, even if everybody had a smartphone, and not enough people would have had smartphones for it to have been worth people's effort, right, to engage. And then you have regulatory inflections, which is my favorite recent example is telemedicine across state lines. And so it used to be in the United States, you cannot practice telemedicine visits across state lines. Now you can. And so what does that mean for the market for a startup telemedicine provider? It redefines the market opportunity. And then the last is more subtle. I call it belief inflections. And so back to the telemedicine example, I think a lot of people have done telemedicine visits now, maybe an order of magnitude people because of COVID-19. So are we heading into a world where people say, you know what, I used to not really think about doing visits that way, but now I kind of think all things being equal, that's how I'm going to do it. Or I can work from home more than I thought. And so like, to me, all of those inflections are what give the entrepreneur the force multiplying asymmetric power to change the subject, right? Those are the things that are like a gathering wave in the ocean that's more powerful than any force that's currently around. And so what you want to do if you want to find a breakthrough insight is, first of all, develop a set of inflection ideas. And then armed with those inflections, you have conversations with, I like to say, practitioners who are living in the present and seers who are living in the future. And you kind of want to ping pong between the two. And the types of conversations you have with each type of person are different, because people living in the present don't like to have futuristic conversations. People living in the future very often don't want to be bothered by the tactics of building a product right now.
How do you develop the ability to sort of like go from likely, possible, or probable and into, what was the other one that you used? The other word? Preposterous. How do you learn to think about the future in that way? Because I mean, we're so, the education system is almost opposite of that, right? It's like, here's a very narrow band. You can project forward a day or two and, you know, the cone of the future that you see, even though it might be really wide at the end, you know, what you see is almost like a beam of light.
Right. And this is why it's so important to get into the right headspace. Knowing that the future can be defined by determined people and understanding that there's a process for considering alternative futures other than looking forward for the present is the key. And so you get out of the present by talking to these seers and riffing on the different types of potential futures. And so, you know, if I think of plausible futures, a great example is an entrepreneur that I was lucky to work with, still working with, Todd McKinnon and Freddie Karrest at Okta. And so Todd had been head of engineering at Salesforce, and he sees that Salesforce is blowing up and that customers are having these problems using the cloud. They're early adopters of the cloud. So when I met Todd, he says, I think the cloud is going to be a thing. I think there's going to be a lot of big cloud companies. And I think that cloud customers are going to have problems reconciling all their cloud apps. And I know a lot of these customers, and I have a good line of sight on what their problems will be because I'm solving technical problems for them today. So when you hear that, it's kind of like, you know, I can't unsee that now, right? That sounds totally plausible to me that he's right. And it sounds totally plausible to me that if anybody could figure this out, he could. And if anybody had an authentic set of ideas for how it would get solved, it would be him. And so to me, that's why it's a plausible insight. Once you hear it, you're like, oh yeah, of course. Andreessen is a great example of the notion of a possible future. So a lot of those start as a hobby. So Mark was at the University of Illinois working on a supercomputer. He was in a lab, actually, networked scientists, and he was trying to get people to collaborate better. And so he invented the Mosaic browser and web server to make the internet immediately more useful for him. And so Mark was living in a time machine. He was already living in the future. When you're living in the future and you notice something that's missing, your intuition is way more likely to be right. Whereas if what most people do when they start mundane startups is they start in the present and they go interview a bunch of customers and they ask them, what are your pains? And they try to solve the pain. Well, the problem is now you're in the headspace of the present. And so even if you're right, your idea is probably going to be small, and or it's not going to be a big idea for reasons you don't understand. But the likelihood that someone has tried that idea, if you solved present pain, is like 100%, right? So like, you don't even have to know who's tried it to know it's too obvious to have not been tried by somebody. So why hasn't it worked yet? Either it's a bad idea that doesn't work in the real world, or, you know, perhaps nobody in history has ever been as good as you as an entrepreneur doing that idea. But it's like, you know, ideas about solving pain in the present are usually mundane for that reason. even if you're right, it's kind of a small idea. It gets acquired by one of the big guys in the space.
And how do we think, like, how do we map this as you're talking? I'm thinking like Steve Jobs and his reputation as having this reality distortion field and like creating the future and like almost pulling people into the future versus saying like, this is the future and I'm going to convince you. It's more like, no, I'm going to reach back into the past and pull you to this. Or Elon Musk and Mars would be like another example, right?
Elon would be a preposterous future, right? Like Elon
but
says,
he creates it.
Yeah, he's like, I'm going to build a car company when one hasn't succeeded in 50 years, and I'm going to charge lots of money, and it's going to be electric. Or I'm going to create rockets and blast them into outer space when NASA hasn't even been doing that lately. And so when Elon's talking about first principles thinking, on some level, he's describing inflections that he pulls together into a preposterous product. You know, a Tesla has advances in battery technology, advances in sensor technology, AI, machine learning, network effects, all of those things come together into all a product that would have seemed preposterous, but can actually happen if you project out into the future where these inflections will converge someday. Steve Jobs, you know, you brought him up in the reality distortion field. I think that's a really insightful question because it gets at something subtle that I think is important. You have practitioners or people who live in the present, and you have seers or people who live in the future. But what an entrepreneur is, when they're doing their job well, on some level, they're a time traveler. They go out into the future. They develop a perspective on futures that are more likely than people in the present realize based on the inflections. But now they've got more work to do. They have to come back to the present and they have to start a movement. And they have to convince early followers of that movement to come to this new future with them. And as the movement accelerates, what was once a non-consensus and non-conventional heretical insight becomes the accepted conventional wisdom. And now it's no longer a startup, it's a company. And now it's no longer just a movement, it's a market. And so this is part of why you need to have a reality distortion field when you're an entrepreneur. Like, nobody rational would buy a product from a startup that's probably going to go out of business. No rational employee would join a startup, you know, crazy team when it's probably going to go out of business. So there has to be something that's animating that decision that's more than just a rational if then what else statement. It's got to be, you know what, I can't unsee that future now. I want to make that future happen too. I'll feel worse for not being part of making that new future happen than I will if we try and we fail.
Does the reward accrue higher to the preposterous ones versus sort of the plausible ones?
Not always, but I think usually you could predict that that's likely, right? Because the more preposterous a future seems, the more rare the product or insight is likely to be. And so, you know, you're likely to not just break free of a mundane insight, but you're likely to break free of competition. The best competitive strategy is just not to have any competitors, not to be the best, but to be the only. And so the more preposterous your insight is, the more likely it is that you're wrong, but the more likely it is that if you're right, you're the only.
A lot of my friends have these wacky ideas and I'm like, oh, you should go build that. You should go do that. And they're like, oh man, I don't want to look like an idiot. And I always tell them, you know, if you're unwilling to look like an idiot, you're never going to do anything amazing.
Oh, totally. Right. And it's like, you know, how many people have you ever seen that say, oh, yeah, I had the idea for Twitter. You know, I was talking to my buddy in a bar about that 5 years ago. I should have done that. And I'm like, dude, you have no clue what it is to start and actually build Twitter.
Oh, man. But that's the best because you can just go back to those people and be like, oh, that must really bother you, right? Like that must really keep you awake at night because you had this idea that could have been, you know, this multi-billion dollar product used by billions of people around the world and you just sat on it.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, the reality is, right, you had to will that sucker into existence. What kind of team and like what are the steps along the way and how do you convince others when, you know, it doesn't seem likely to normal people that it's going to work. You know, I mean, that's the real work of entrepreneurship. That's where the real time travel happens when you're bouncing between the future and the present, you know, in perpetual motion, bringing them closer together.
Was it us that talked about that last time about, you know, ideas are cheap and easy and execution is actually everything.
The way I would modify it is a great insight is like the Archimedes lever of an entrepreneur. It's the thing that when it's moved, it moves the world. But you still, it still requires movement. And it's like movement is about execution and it's about, you know, and where does strategy begin and execution end? Not always clear, right? But it's sort of like you want to you want to be strategic in the makeup of your team and the niche markets that sectors that you target at first, and who do you pick as your innovative customers and who do you pick as your later customers? But you also just have to move, you know, work. It's kind of like in physics, you got to move some real mass through some real distance every day. And so, like I like to say to founders, out in the future, there's a ton of insights. Some of them are plausible, some are possible, some are preposterous. And on some level, as a founder, what insight fits you? Like what insight fits your risk profile, your expertise, your ability to assemble a great team? You know, that's the bet you're making. And so like there's this kind of two parts of the bet, right? One is the head part of the bet, which we've kind of talked about. And the heart part of the bet is it's the part where you say, fuck yeah, we're doing this, right? Like I can't not think about it. It's the last thing I think about when I go to bed. It's the first thing I think about when I get up in the morning. You can make a breakthrough happen, even if you think that you're an ordinary person, right? If you use the right tools and you commit yourself to creating breakthroughs, you can do extraordinary things. You can find your lever to move the world. And by the way, that's not just a statement about entrepreneurship. You know, Rosa Parks did that. Elvis Presley had a tune. He did that, right? Yeah. Einstein had an equation. He did that. You know, Thomas Keller of the French Laundry had a recipe. He did that. I think all of us in our society, regardless of what institution we're in or part of, have a chance to say, I'm going to have my life be about breakthroughs. If I'm a government agency, I'm going to have my life be about not just working on this problem, but just destroying, crushing this problem, transcending this problem with a solution that's such a breakthrough that we'll never go back. I think that's true in the media. I think that's true in our politics. I think it's true in the Fortune 500 spent $800 billion buying back its own stock last year. What does that say about their willingness or desire to build breakthroughs or their courage to build breakthroughs? Not much. So I kind of feel like you don't have much time. It's okay if you want to go with the flow, but boy, we could sure use a lot more people who want to create breakthroughs, who are willing to do what it takes, but also are willing to like study and learn the tools and the frameworks that increase the odds, because, you know, we need all the help we can get right now.
That's an awesome place to end this conversation. Thank you so much, Mike.
All right. Thanks, Shane. It was good talking again.
Thanks for listening to Starting Greatness. You can follow me on Twitter at M2JR, and please shoot me an email with any comments or questions to greatness@floodgate.com. I hope you'll subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, I'd be grateful if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Never let go of your inner power to do great things in whatever matters to you. And until we meet again, remember, greatness is a decision.